Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:16 on this Wednesday morning. Well, the Park City Board of Education received another budget briefing and safety update at their meeting yesterday. They also received some training on how to be leaders. Joining me now in the studio with some of the highlights there, I have school board members J.J. Ellers and Petra Butler. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, let's just start with the news that we're reporting this morning that the Treasure Mountain Junior High School teacher last week suspended after a few parents complained about the teacher using an Eminem song to start a conversation about bias. Can either of you give us some context to this?
You know, Petra? I think people have a lot of context based upon what they've seen in the news thus far. And as far as the board is concerned, this is a personnel issue. It's being handled by HR. It's something the board would not get involved with. So at this point, I really don't have a lot of information about what's transpired. But if parents have concerns, they're welcome to reach out to the interim superintendent, Dave Gomez, or to Tim McConnell in HR.
Yeah. Do you know how many parents complained, or were they students complaining either? Or?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Well, let's just talk about then just the teaching aspect of this, the educational aspect of this, the teacher apparently trying to teach bias. And apparently there was going to be another side to the Eminem song, but we'll never know what that was because the teacher was stopped short of finishing the lesson. And I guess when we talk about educating students and especially about the issue of bias, I mean, is the classroom the appropriate place for discussions like this to be happening with 14-year-old students?
You know, I think that's a really good question. I think that's a topic of conversation as we move forward with strategic and master planning about the programs that parents want to see in our schools, along with diversity and equity. So I think this is a good conversation to be having, and I think it's something that we will be discussing as we move forward.
And I think there's people out there who feel like we have lost the message here, and it's because we don't want to talk about. And when we think about all of the money, time, and resources we have spent over the last couple of years to bring issues out into the open, to stop the stigmas, to stop the mental health issues, to stop the hiding and the secrecy of you know, forbidden topics. I mean, instead of just shutting people down, I mean, because we don't like what they have to say, how do we move forward from something like this?
I wish I knew. I mean, I don't know that there's any really good, easy answers to it. And it's a community discussion that needs to happen throughout the entire community, not just in the schools are part of it, but it's really a community discussion that we need to all start having, because we need to figure out how to listen to the other side and how to hear the other side. And I wish I knew the answer, and unfortunately, I personally don't know what the right answer is, other than we need to try to open our minds and listen to the other side. And you know, when it enters the public school, it becomes another issue, because it's back to everything. It's really a community question, and how we all come together as a community to live together. To be part of a community, and it's not just a school issue, even though this one is in the school. I don't know.
And I certainly feel for you, because it's you know, if we're not talking about issues like biasism and racism and bullying and intolerance in our schools, where do we talk about it?
You're absolutely right. And think about some of the really tough issues we've tackled over the last years in this district. I mean, whether it's been the opioid crisis that we've been dealing with, whether it's suicide, whether it's bullying. I mean, these are all things that we've been very open and talking about and putting measures in place in our schools to address. And I think, Leslie, this is another topic that we're going to have to address head on. We're going to have to figure out how we're going to deal with this issue and how we're going to move forward. And I think it's going to be a topic of discussion for the new superintendent to come in about how we are going to effectively deal with that within our schools.
Yeah. And when I look at, again, and I haven't listened to the song in question that kids were reading, but and I certainly know Eminem music, and I know it can be certainly vulgar at times. But here we've got that. And then at the same time, we've got our kindergarten students, you know, that we're training them to respond to active shootings in a school. And I think that's so traumatizing, I'm thinking, for some kids. And here we are, we're trying to prepare our children for the realities of potential violence on a school grounds, and yet won't talk about Eminem's lyrics.
Right, and part of it is also a parent issue. Is what do parents want their children? I mean, and that's the hard part. Is I might say, I personally want my child to listen to Eminem song, and then I want him to listen to other song, and I want him to have that discussion. But I, as a parent, have where do the parents have a say in it? And I think that's where the questions come in, and in, where this became an issue is that some parents chose not to have their children be part of that, and so we're going to have to figure out how at where those lines are drawn within the schools, and it is an issue that the community and the superintendent are going to have to work on together to figure out where those lines are, because the lines for me might be different than the lines for Petra, and where and what rights do we, I mean, isn't it her right to choose how what her children are going to hear? And that's the hard part, is that we may not agree on it and have to come to the conclusion on that. I mean, personally, I would love to have that discussion with my children, and we will be having that discussion next time I have my 20-somethings at home.
Do we know what happens to the teacher at this point?
That's a personnel issue. And we can't know, because if it reaches us where the
there's some sort of a dispute,
or something, we would be the arbitrator. So correct. We have to kind of stay out of that part of it.
All right. There was an announcement that the high school was going to include homeroom in the schedule, but they seems like we've backed off that plan. Can you give us an update on that?
You know, I think during that process, the board was not made aware of it, first of all. So when we heard about this information from parents in the community, we immediately went to the superintendent to inquire. And I guess there had been discussions about this, but the board had not been informed. I think parents had also not been informed. So I think the process that we would like to typically see in the district about how we make informed decisions skipped a few steps. And so I think it's incumbent upon the district to go back and look at what we did and how we can do it better in the future. I think it's a topic for discussion that we're going to be looking at next year. But I think we have to include our stakeholders, which most importantly are parents, and how this is going to affect them and their students.
Well, let's talk a little bit about more of that, because this was an issue that was raised in the hour and a half training that you had with Marianne Billington with Action Leadership, focusing on working together as a board. Just maybe a step back here. I mean, what are we paying for this training? Do we know that?
I want to say, and I'm not positive, I want to say the initial training was about $5,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And yesterday's hour and a half training was just part of it? I mean, what else happens? So what else are we getting for our money?
Yes, absolutely. It's multiple training. So mm-hmm. This was just the start of it. Actually, she had individual meetings with us first. She's also going to have individual meetings with stakeholders. Yesterday was kind of a inventory, if you will, mm-hmm. where we had to fill out a questionnaire and answer some different thoughts and ideas about how we would handle certain types of situations. It kind of put us into three categories, whether we were more focused on people, process, or performance. And it was interesting to see how each of the board members on the little chart that presented to us actually fell into which categories, and how we could all work together based on how our different perceptions were identified in the process.
So since the mission of the school board is to elevate children, I'm guessing that people came out on top, or I mean...
It was actually all over the place, yeah. People were definitely involved. But, you know, one of the interesting things is if you looked at how we charted, she said we are the first board that she's dealt with...
That charted that way.
And that we were really a decision-driven group of individuals that we want to make positive decisions for our students. Very positive.
So what's the goal here, and how do we get there?
The goal is we're going to continue to work together. I think we heard very loud and clear from our community when there was a lot of discussions about how the board was operating and not maybe operating in a manner that the community liked to see. And we heard that very loud and clear. So we took it upon ourselves to how do we do that? And training was one of the options. So that's why we brought in this group to facilitate that.
And I think another thing along the way is that coming in as a board, there's a lot of understanding on how to work together and what it means to work together as a board. That's not always It seems obvious, but it's not always obvious when you're in there working on it. Just the governance issues and the protocol between each other and everything, and that really having somebody come in from the outside and help train and help develop those with the board is very important. And it's a step we had missed really a year and a half ago when we had Patron Andrew came into the board. And I think it's having done it when I came on, I really feel like that we missed it and that this is really something that's necessary, especially when you have a large, even two to three new members on a board. And in our case, we really have four new members within the last year and a half. To just understand how a board works together and how we, the dynamics of us, and how that works with the superintendent and the other administrators and community and constituents and stakeholders that we deal with and where all those pieces fall in those relationships.
You heard from the consultant that the Park City School Board is at the bottom four of the top 10 school boards when it comes to public relations, communication, and providing information to the community. Now, this comes even after we've hired a full-time public relations director. So what do you think that needs to be done to address this?
We made it into the top 10.
That's really good. But you know what? She said we were really, really good at being reactive. We just needed to work on the proactive end. And I think that's something that we realize that we need to do. Exactly how we want to go about doing that is something that we've already talked about as a board with an incoming superintendent about how we want to get information mm-hmm. out and that whole transparency to take that to the next level.
And that is what is leading me right now into part of your discussion yesterday. And when you bring up earlier about home rule, how you guys didn't know about it, we didn't know about it here in the media. We had a question raised by a school board member during yesterday's training about school board members specifically coming on the radio. And some of you saying you don't want to come on the radio. But don't you see this as an opportunity to provide the information? The transportation and to seek input from taxpayers?
I do, and I'll be honest. I don't like coming on the radio, and if you look at my personality, I'm more of a logical thinker. So I want my questions so that I know what my answers are going to be. I don't like to be put on the spot. So that's why it's difficult for me to come on the radio because I'm always second-guessing what I'm going to say or whatever. It's not that I don't want to come and share with people. It's that I don't want to give the wrong answer because I haven't had a chance to think it through before I say it or say something that comes out wrong. And so I think that's where we need to kind of understand how best to come on the radio and be able to talk that's within our comfort zone, not that we don't want to share with the public. It's more of how to get out of our comfort zones and do it properly.
And I think I just want to jump in there real quick. I think I want to add for some of us, we actually had to campaign and had to go through debates. And I think cutting your teeth, so to speak, is a big part of whether you're comfortable coming into a situation like this. And so when we have board members that end up being appointed or run unopposed, they don't have the opportunity to do that. And I think the other thing that we talked a little bit about is when we come in on a Wednesday, we hope that we're going to focus on what was discussed at Tuesday's board meetings. But you being the investigative reporter that you are, you love to throw in a lot of things that aren't necessarily something that we discussed on Tuesday. And so there's a comfort factor that's no longer there when we walk in. So I think to help some of the board members, if we knew something was going to be asked that we didn't have on at the Tuesday meeting, that you might let us know so that we can come in prepared. And it's not so that we can have some sort of a stock answer. It's just I would much rather be able to provide an answer than to say, I don't know, I'm going to have to get back to you.
Right. I haven't been at the meeting, though, right?
Right.
You guys
right.
understand that. So
no.
I'm just kind of really basing it all on intuition here, right?
And so maybe we come in on Thursdays or, those are things that we need to maybe, work on a little bit as we figure out what are the best way to do it.
Okay. Don't have a whole lot more time, but let's talk budget. A very long conversation on funding two more special ed's full-time employees. Did we decide whether or not we're going to do that?
Yes.
Yes.
We will do that.
We
yes.
will do that. Mm-hmm.
So in terms of how many full-time employees that we're adding to next year's school budget, where are we at? 11?
I think we're at 21 total.
All right. And in
terms of those, some of those were FTEs based on enrollment, though. I mean, you know, so it's hard to, it's not like 21 are totally, I mean, they're new, but they're, you know, to keep class sizes the right size, et cetera.
Right. Some of them are DLI teachers. Yeah. I mean, some of them are just required.
Right.
There was some discussion about hiring some of these people, perhaps holding off on the positions until we have a new special ed director in place. I think, JJ, you expressed concern about waiting on that. It's not a great situation to bring on a mid-year hire. Is that why? Or
right, especially in special ed, where there's a lot of comfort level with the students, with their who the teacher is to add somebody mid-year seem like it might not be the best course of action, and to change up the routines for those students who very many of them thrive on routine, that I felt like it would be better to have them in when school starts, so when the students come in, they can start the routine and have the teacher for the entire year.
And Petra, you had commented that special ed teachers don't have a place to go if they have questions or need support. What did you mean by that?
Well, if you think about it, Leslie, our director of special ed left last December, and we really haven't had somebody in place. I don't think we appointed Tracy Shostrom until much later in the year, and she was also new to that position. So there really was not a point of contact that if you had questions that you could go to and get them answered. You know, if you ask different people different questions, you might always get different answers. And so that was some of the things that I heard from special ed teachers.
Okay. We do have a new special ed director, though, coming in, August 1?
August 1st, yes.
All right. Safety update. We've got fencing materials apparently on the way. We're going to start actually on Monday of being the last day of school here,
yes.
Huh?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And it'll be ready in time with the fencing and vestibules by first day of school?
That is the plan.
Yes.
That's what we're pushing for, yes.
Okay. And you guys are okay with, even though you keep hearing from, well, at least one parent who is a bit concerned about we're doing this. I mean, for the most part, you guys are pretty okay with where we're headed here.
Oh, absolutely.
It's the right thing to do.
And I think most of the community as well, I think we've done a really good job of being good neighbors and listening to their concerns, having many, many one-on-one conversations. The individual that you were talking about, Leslie, that I've actually reached out to and offered to meet with them, sit down one-on-one, it was not accepted. And so I think as board members, we've done what I would really consider to be due diligence to try to meet the needs of our community.
But it's also, you know, important to meet the needs of our students and keep them safe. And sometimes we have to make decisions that aren't always in the best interest of the community, but are in the best interest of our students. And this is one of those, or could be considered one of those times.
So when we look at the safety projects, the 21 new employees, where's all the money coming from?
You know, there will be a tax increase. There's going to have to be a tax increase in order to cover this.
And have we figured out what that number is going to be at this point?
Not specifically. We're still working on that.
All right. And you've got, the final budget approval on the 19th? Is that what
yes. happens? Yes. And then truth and taxation will be in August. And it'll be the August time frame when we will be deciding on the actual tax increase.
Do you have a meeting before the 19th?
The meeting on the 19th, it will be open to the community. So for anybody who's interested in hearing specifically or having comments or questions, you're invited to attend.
Yeah, that'll be the hearing. Yeah.
All right. Because, Petra, yesterday you had brought up during the budget discussion that you'd like to have the school board perhaps consider a pay raise there.
Right.
Is that part of next year's budget?
No. That will be something that we will look at next year as part of the following year's budget. So it's not going to be included in this year's budget.
Okay. What do you guys make?
I want to say it's about $5,000
a year.
It's $6,000 a year plus insurance.
Okay, if you choose to take it.
Right.
And
right.
What you had mentioned, I think, Petra, that teachers had received a $7,000 pay increase last year. I mean, what are you thinking of in terms of what's fair for board members?
You know, I don't know that there's really a fair number. I think when the city chose to increase the pay for their council, they had some sort of a commission that was put together to look at that and review it. And I think that's exactly what Andrew was suggesting yesterday, that we have a committee put together out in the community to look at that. And I think that's what we're planning to do sometime next year. I don't know that there's a number. My concern is along the lines of the candidates that we're getting to fill the positions. And I don't know if finance would be something that would be considered when people are looking at exploring the possibility of joining the school board. It's just another piece of the puzzle that I think we need to take a look at.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Today is the last day of school. Yay! You know what? Please, folks, when you're picking up your kids today, thank the teachers. Thanks everybody in the district. It's been another wonderful year. And enjoy your summer.
And keep your students safe this summer.
JJ and Petra, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
It's the 1-4. Well, the Park City Council meets in work session Thursday starting at 4 o'clock in the studio with a preview of the agenda. City Manager Diane Foster and Budget Manager Nate Rock. Well, good morning.
Good morning.
So the first half hour of work session will be a review of the budget. Nate, give us the highlights here. I mean, the plan is to increase fees, to look at the five-year capital plan for the water fund, as well as some special service contracts. Anything being proposed that residents should be aware of before the June 21st adoption?
Well, I think we're still continuing to look at the Treasure Hill issue, and so we're going to continue to talk about what the bond amount should be, and kind of if there's some capital projects that we should delay or defer. We really want to get the community input on weighing in on what the Treasure Hill bond should be, and where that balance is between maintaining the infrastructure and setting that bond amount.
Right. What is the bond amount that's being proposed at this point? Are we at 51 million or are we going to go up to the 55?
We're still in between the 55 and the 50 and really just waiting until we get input and make the final budget. But we put the option of this is what 55 would be. This is what a 51 would be. These are the projects that you'd, defer some of these Old Town Street projects that we would defer, the lower sidewalks on Main, some of those sort of projects. So just still input.
Yeah. And that's kind of the projects that we've been talking about, sidewalks, streets, whether we decrease plowing, things like that. But I mean, those are the only options. I mean, when you look at the five-year water capital budget, I mean, can you reduce that at all?
You could reduce that, but you really wouldn't be able to put water funds into an open space purchase. So there's different buckets of funds that really just can't interact that way. So no, I mean, we're also very much seeking input on the water fees and the water projects. A lot of that's mandated. One of the things that they talked about last week and we'll continue to talk about this week is the water rates. And so there was a proposed 6% increase with a 5% next year. As we've kind of looked at that, looked at how we can structure the debt, we've really been able to say, I think we can get away with doing a 3% increase and a 3% and reduce that burden on water ratepayers. And so that's, when we look at the whole picture, you're saying, okay, we want to keep things affordable. We know the Treasure Hill bond is going to impact that. So we are looking at how do we keep water rates as low as we can so that the affordability of the town. So that those fees don't go towards it, but at the same time, we are looking, taking a balanced approach and trying to keep things as affordable as possible.
Is it fair to say that the largest expense for city government is personnel?
Yeah.
So if that's the case, I mean, can we cut staff, save some money there?
When you look at cutting staff, you get some little returns on that. I think that the quality of service is pretty high, and I think people expect that to be high. So, you say, oh, you should be cutting staff until you come in and you want a building permit or something like that. And then you're saying, why don't you have enough staff to turn my building permit around right away? So we are really trying to take this balanced approach of keeping the level of service for the core of the city and the resort economy and everything balanced. And, we're really looking at Treasure as this is an opportunity for the community to decide what kind of community it is. If you want to kind of go with the flow and allow the market to dictate where the community goes and where development goes, that's kind of not getting involved in doing open space bonds. If you kind of want to be more proactive in saying this is the type of community that we want to be, that's the choice that the community has. And so there's a certain aspect where you really want to put those big decisions out to the voter to say, what are you willing to pay for and what kind of a community do you want to be? Development is a big deal it has a big impact on the lives of the citizens here. And so it really makes sense to say, you have a chance to go out and decide what kind of city you want to be. These are the type of decisions that you want. You know, the city has gone through these negotiations really to bring it to the voters and say, this is the opportunity you have. What do you want to do? And so that's really the way that it's kind of being laid out.
So back to the personnel thing, I mean, what kind of pay raises are we talking about for staff and council?
How pay works at the city is we benchmark. You know, I was talking with a resident last night who said, oh, well, city salaries just increase based on how long you've been here. That's not true in Park City. We actually benchmark, and city council has said we want to be at the average of the top five cities. Now, that is well below any cost of living. There's no cost of living increase in the Park City area. What we do is benchmark against those top five cities because we do actually compete for staff, particularly in areas like the building department, et cetera. So there are, and the pay plan went to council on May 3rd in a public hearing, and there are some increases in some areas and there are not in others. And there are many staff at the city who, because of their longevity, have maxed out on their salary, and we don't increase it because they've been here longer.
So the top five cities in Utah?
Top five cities in Utah. So we do not even benchmark against other resort towns where, you know, typically people make more money in other resort towns than they do in Utah. Utah is among the lowest government salaries in the nation.
Nate, last night at the Treasure Hill panel, you noted that we do have the bond capacity to take on the additional $55 million. That along with the water projects that we'll have to bond for, Bonanza Flat, and our existing debt. So we're with money to spare or with bonding to.
Yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, since the city has kind of gone, you know, since the state has gone to this truth and taxation, the city has never raised its property tax for operations. But when you look at how the city is bonded, we've always been at the very short end of 15-year bonds. And what that means is that you're able to pay off those bonds and retire those quicker, meaning that you have more capacity to make future decisions. And so that's the reason why the bond ratings are so high. That's the reason why when you look at, is this a high-risk community, then from a paying off its debt standpoint, the rating agency says, no, you're taking very conservative, very financially smart decisions on how you bond and how much you actually leverage. And then when you look at the property tax base, it's, you know, a resort economy, incredibly fortunate, and there is a lot of value there. So,
Diane, I'd like you to respond to the criticism that last night's panel that was sponsored by Park City Mountain Resort to answer questions about the Treasure Hill bond was stacked with pro-bond people.
Sure. Actually, it was an information session. So while it wasn't intended to be a debate, the city was quite transparent with the right up front. Miles Radiman said, this is a city-sponsored event, and what we want to do is provide information. And so we wanted to have people like Ann McCoy, who was on the city council, who approved it, and explained the why, which I learned information, and I think I know a lot about this project, and I learned information from Ann. It included people like Rory Murphy, who is a developer, and we wanted to specifically hear from his experience. Was it buildable? He said it absolutely is buildable, and also some of the valuations and also what positive impact it could have on property tax values. At the end of the day, and the mayor ended with this, this is about giving people a choice. This is not a, you know, the city is putting it to the voters and is saying, this is a absolutely you get to decide, and we will absolutely live with whatever the voters want, whichever direction they want to go.
Okay. And then last night, Nate, you had calculated the cost to a resident for the treasure bond, something like $220 per year for 15 years. Who are we talking about here? I mean, are these the people that are moving into the new affordable houses or this?
No, so that's based on if you go and you take the primary resident value and then take the average of what the primary assessed or taxable value is. So it's based on, this is what the average primary resident is paying.
Is that average assessed valuation?
It's 400 and, is around 430 is what the, so that's not the assessed value, but that's the taxable value after you take the 55% of the assessed value.
Okay, so for every $400,000 of taxable value, then people would pay $220?
Yeah, if it was a $55 million bond. If it was a $50 million bond, it's about $200.
Okay. Well, we're still waiting to get somebody on the phone. So while we do that, then, Diane, at 4:30, a discussion of food trucks. Is this in response to the state legislation? And maybe just tell us where food trucks can't go if this is adopted.
It is. I will give you a couple highlights. One is that the state basically changed the code and said you have to allow food trucks. And so, and they do distinguish between public and private property. You know, the city has very, we've protected our restaurant association and we've regulated food trucks quite tightly. We've met with a lot of the stakeholders and found out from them that they are supportive of something you call it administrative CUP, a conditional use permit. They're also supportive of allowing food trucks on public property in areas like Queens Junction, where there aren't any, where there isn't any food available, and also allowing them for special events. This will be something that the City Council will discuss. It's gone to Planning Commission, and they provided some recommendations on what zones it would be allowed in, and also they can be on private property as well.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention about the agenda that people?
I think the big one that we want people to know about is are two things. One is there's staff is coming back with the special events discussion and balancing the special events calendar. Staff is actually requesting a continuation specifically so we can get the word out on what these recommendations are. They may impact if we're recommending grandfathering certain events, and we're recommending that council allow staff to implement some additional tools as far as protecting certain weekends, about not allowing big events on weekends where there are other big events and pieces like that. And we really do want to hear from the nonprofit community as well as the citizens about what this looks like. And this would actually be short of creating an events commission. From a staff perspective, we just want council's feedback on that of do they think that this would meet their goals on reducing that.
I have to mention, though, at the same time, the council scheduled to adopt the 2 days of Tour of Utah.
Absolutely.
Well, and why would we do that without having the special events policy in place?
The specifically because of the timing. The other piece, though, is that staff is and SEAC, the Special Events Advisory Committee, is specifically recommending that there, if there are events that support the local economy and they have a disproportionate support of that local economy, that those be considered. This very much brings people to town. It is a very big event. It also fits with our community culture of sports and recreation and cycling. So that's part of the reason. And on events, I will also mention that, remind people that the 4th of July applications are due to the city this Friday, June 8th, and you have another week after that to submit it, but fees double. So please do get your 4th of July float applications in by this Friday.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nate Rockwood and Diane Foster. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. This weekend, the Park City Film Series presents the documentary RBG, an introspective into the 85-year-old Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Following the screening on Sunday evening, I'll be moderating a panel to talk more about the issues of gender equity. On the phone, I have one of the panelists, Marina Lowe. She's the Legislative and Policy Counsel for the ACLU of Utah. Joining me in studio, I have the director of the Park City Film Series, Katie Wang. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Katie, why don't you start, just give us the basics of the film screenings and a little bit about the film.
Sure. So we're showing the film this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, June 8th through 10th, Friday and Saturday 8th, Sunday at 6. And the film came here through the Sundance Film Festival and just was one of those hot tickets that everybody wanted to see and probably didn't get a chance to, because, of course, tickets are limited. But, you know, as you mentioned, it examines the extraordinary life and career of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and just illuminates the extent to which the impact that she's had on women's rights and certainly on civil rights, using law as an instrument for change. And like, you feel like you know a lot about Ruth Bader Ginsburg probably going into the movie, and you have no idea. I mean, just the extraordinary life that this woman has had, just how she's been a groundbreaker and a revolutionary, but in her really own unique way. I mean, just a quiet, kind of diminutive person, but just searing intellect, incisive language. I mean, she's probably best known now for her Dissents, you know, the notorious RBG. And it's just an incredibly powerful film that we're excited to bring back to our community and certainly for the young people in our community, because she is, you know, to all extents and purposes, you know, a modern day hero.
All right. Well, talk a little bit about the panel then that you've assembled. And this, again, will just be after Sunday's screening.
Yep. So what we wanted to do with the panels, we've curated with the help of the ACLU, a panel that reflects the different points on Justice Ginsburg's career. So we have Marina Lowe from representing the ACLU. We'll have Professor Erica George from the University of Utah. She's a law professor who is well known for her work on human rights issues around the world. And then we'll have Utah Supreme Court Justice Paige Peterson, who was confirmed in 2017. And this is a woman who, she's taken on mob boss attorneys and cross-examined Serbian warlords. I mean, all of these women are, in their own rights, incredibly powerful and had, you know, extraordinary careers. And we felt that they would do justice to Justice Ginsburg.
All right. And Marina, have you had the opportunity to see the film?
First, let me just say thank you so much. I'm so flattered by those comments, Katie. I really appreciate it. And I feel very lucky to be able to talk about this topic and to join those other women who I respect myself in talking about her life. I have not seen the film, and so I'm so excited to get a chance to view it on Sunday and then to chat a little bit about it with the fellow panelists and members of the audience.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about Justice Ginsburg's history with the ACLU, because she goes way back with it.
She certainly does, yes, and we're so proud to call her one of our own. She joined the ACLU in the 70s. At that time, she was a professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey, and had experienced some discrimination in the workplace herself at Rutgers University, which I think sort of was one of those prominent moments in her life that sort of guided her interest in this subject area. And so she started consulting with the ACLU of New Jersey and consulting on a number of sex discrimination cases. And after a few years, I believe it was in 1972, after a really prominent case went forward, Reed versus Reed, in which she was involved and the ACLU was involved as well, the ACLU hired her and brought her on board with our organization to really start up the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU. The ACLU had been working on behalf of women for decades prior, but I think bringing Ruth Bader Ginsburg on board really cemented our organization's dedication to women's rights, and under her leadership and her guidance really caused our litigation in the area of sex discrimination to swell. We had, I think, 300 different cases that were brought during the decade that she worked at the ACLU.
Has it helped, though? I mean, has it made a difference?
Well, I think so. You know, so many of the battles that the ACLU fights, and women's rights are one of these battles, are not easily solved and are not instantly solved, but take time. And, you know, obviously we believe that the arc of justice moves towards success, but nevertheless it's, you know, fighting battles over and over again, making incremental progress, which is something I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg believes in, rather than oftentimes sweeping change, which can have negative consequences. And so, yes, I would say I believe that there have been successes along the way, and there continue to be challenges that make our work continue to be relevant.
And at the same time, we still know that women make less money per hour doing the same job as men. Is that ever going to change?
I hope so. I really do hope so. I feel incredibly inspired by a lot of sort of the current events that are going on at the moment, the Me Too movement, the sort of increase we're seeing in women who are stepping up and deciding they want to become involved in politics, which I think is sort of a necessary step to achieve equality. And so I think there's a lot to remain hopeful about, and I think we will see these changes happen, but I think there is no doubt that one of the biggest threats really to the women's rights movement is this idea that somehow we've solved the problem that women are equal to men. That certainly is not the case, and I think the 2016 election is a very clear example of the way in which we still need to strive for equality in lots of different ways.
Yeah. Who are today's Betty Friedans and Gloria Steinems?
Well, you know, I think it's really young people that are going to be stepping up. I am so encouraged to see the excitement of youth, even just the young people's attraction to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, I think, as was mentioned in the introduction, she's sort of a modern-day hero for young people. So I think that's really inspiring, seeing the young people in Florida and Parkland High School stepping up and encouraging political activism. I think that's where we're going to see a lot of the next wave of sort of women's rights heroes are in this next generation who are stepping up and who are engaged in a way that I don't think we've seen in a few decades.
And, you know, when you talk about the 70s and the 80s, of course, it was all about the National Organization of Women. We had, of course, Gloria Steinem and Miss Magazine and, of course, the Equal Rights Amendment. How relevant is the ERA today? I mean, given the rulings that have been made over the years with regard to equal protection under the 14th Amendment.
You know, I still think it's critical. I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg would say that herself as well. It's really important to put these sorts of protections into the Constitution so that they're not subject to the whims of Congress or the courts even. And so it is critical to continue to strive for that sort of protection in our founding document. You know, we've seen sort of a resurgence in terms of the ERA. I believe it was Nevada just a few years ago went ahead and ratified the ERA, despite the fact that the time period for ratification has long since expired. There have been a couple of efforts here in Utah as well at the legislature to introduce the measure to ratify the ERA. So the time may be ripe for a reintroduction of that topic, and I think certainly there is a need on a legal level to enshrine these protections in our Constitution once and for all.
All right. Well, I look forward to talking to you about that and other other issues on Sunday. Again, thanks for your time, Marina. And again, the panel will happen right after the screening, so about 7:30-ish?
Yeah, it runs about 97 minutes for the movie. We have tickets for sale online right now at parkcityfilmseries.org. I just want to thank Julie Hopkins, Keller Williams Real Estate, who's our underwriter this weekend. We couldn't do all that we do without the support we receive from our underwriters. So fantastic weekend, Friday, Saturday. At 8, Sunday at 6, and the panel after the Sunday night screening.
Okay, Katie Wang, Marina Lowe, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
KPCW News Time now, 9 o'clock.